Public Employee Retirement System. Preliminary report on earnings and crediting. Today our committee assistant is Karen Segrist, and from the Legislative Fiscal Office for the receipt of the PERS preliminary crediting report, Dallas Wyand. So we'd like to go ahead and have Jim Boyko come forward and give us a required report from the Public Employee Retirement System.
Thank you, Chair Butler. My name is Jim Boyko, and I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. I would like to report today, in accord with ORS 238-670 sub 5, the preliminary decision by the PERS Board with respect to crediting of year 2002 earnings, in this case, losses. I want to make clear that this is something that's required by statute. It's an informational report to the legislature. A final decision by the board is due on by March 31st of 2003, and we anticipate that that will be done on time. First, the facts. There were losses in the year 2002 in the capital markets generally and in the PERS fund specifically. With respect to the amount of the losses, the regular account declined by 8.17%, and that includes Tier 1 and Tier 2. The variable account was down 21.3%. Losses, of course, don't necessarily translate directly into crediting because crediting is a statutory procedure, not a financial one. And with respect to crediting, the board's preliminary decision was to credit Tier 1 regular accounts a positive 8%. As you know from the statute, requires that the assumed rate of 8% be credited to Tier 1 member accounts. With respect to Tier 2, they did suffer the decline of 8.17% that was recorded in the regular fund, and variable accounts were credited a negative 21.3%. This year 2002 crediting continues an issue that began in the year 2001 crediting, and that is the board continues to debate the particular methodology or process for executing the 44 provisions in the statute that must be followed simultaneously to distribute earnings to the many and various accounts within the fund. As you know from previous discussions, there are two theories for executing these 44 provisions. One is called sequential crediting, the other equal crediting or even earnings crediting. The board has continues to have as its official policy the historical policy of equal crediting. However, while this discussion continues, the board has in essence straddled the fence and completed part but not all of the 2001 and now 2002 crediting. It is able to do so because both years were loss years, and what it has done is that it has awarded, if we will, or credited those losses, or in the case of Tier 1, the assumed rate gains, to the member accounts because in these particular circumstances they would be the same under each theory. However, the board has taken the rest of the losses and put them in a pending reserve, anticipating that when the board makes a decision between sequential and equal earnings methodologies, that the 2001 and 2002 creditings will be completed. The losses that are in essence parked in these reserves will be distributed to the retiree reserve and to employer reserve accounts. And that will put to bed the 2001 and 2002 creditings. But for right now, we are in an awkward position with respect to statutory completion of these two critical processes. And I might say that we can continue to do this only so long as the fund records losses. Once there are gains, the board will be forced to make a decision about how these get distributed. I also wanted to give you some quick facts on what the deficit reserve standing of the fund would be. If we were to look at sequential crediting methodology, in that case we create a deficit reserve that only covers Tier 1 member accounts and not any other Tier 1 related account within the fund. After this preliminary crediting, Tier 1 member-related deficit reserve under the statute would have a deficit of approximately $1.9 billion, the largest in the history of the fund. With respect to what the negative reserves might look like under even crediting or equal crediting, the traditional gain-loss reserve approach, and this would be the mirror of the gain-loss reserve, the deficit version of it, the deficit account under equal crediting or the negative gain-loss reserve would be just over $7.9 billion. The largest in the history of the fund. Just to give you a perspective, and I know, Chair Butler, you've seen some analyses that we've done about how good the earnings would have to be for us to earn our way out of the financial difficulty we find ourselves in. We did a hypothetical calculation about how big the returns would need to be in 2003 to get us back to to wipe out the deficits, but not necessarily put us in a positive position going forward. And we would need a 36% return to the fund in 2003, and that translates into something like a 45 to 55% return in the stock market in a single year. It's not something that we anticipate. For sure. The last thing I would say is that we hope to have the end of January estimated UAL for you today. We haven't quite been able to do that because we've been busy doing fiscals for the various committees working on legislative proposals. But I can tell you that looking at the January returns, as of the end of December, the total UAL was about $14.9 billion, and January was not a good month with respect to capital markets returns. In fact, that's an understatement. So we anticipate that the UAL probably grew by at least the amount of the decline plus the amount of another month's worth of heightened liabilities, which happens each and every month our liabilities rise. So we anticipate that it'll be in the neighborhood of $15 billion, maybe somewhat more. This does not include any improvements that we might see from the enactment of HB 2001 or any of the other bills that the PERS committees in the legislature are working on as we speak. I'd be happy to answer questions. BAM is here to also answer questions, and I have my chief financial officer as well.
And the good news just keeps on coming. Is that where we're at? Representative Johnson's recognized.
I'm going to ask this maybe inartfully because I just don't know how to do it any other way. When you're talking about in order to, let me try one more time. You're talking about increases in the stock market that are, or in the portfolio that are so unrealistic as to not be credible. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out, rather than reporting that which cannot happen, reassure me about planning that speaks to reality. Does that make sense?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, let me talk about reality. Reality largely lays currently in the hands of the legislature, and I say that for the following reasons. One is that as poor as these numbers look, when you look at how the fund has done under the guidance of the Oregon Investment Committee, you'll find that it has done as well as public funds generally. This is a stock market decline, a capital markets function. It's not an investment strategy catastrophe. Our funds have performed in line or maybe even better than a number of other public funds. The second is with respect to policies that would either so the funds are doing what they're doing. The other part, of course, is the obligations that the fund is accumulating to its members. We have very little, in fact, almost no influence over the rate at which obligations accrue. Those are driven by the plan structure, which is a legislative document. And so that's why we're working closely with the House PERS Committee, as Chair Butler knows, as well as Senator Corcoran's committee, because if there are any changes in the outlook that are practical and pragmatic, those are likely to come from legislative action, because I cannot think of anything else that lies within our purview to make fundamental financial changes that would be material.
Mr. Johnson, is that responsive?
It is. I think it's fair, and your answer is responsive. The thing that concerns me is that I think there's a tendency in this building to either look to best case or what kind of return you would need in order to have X happen, and that those prognostications are fanciful. And I guess I'm looking for a time when we stop doing that and we say the reality of the situation is X. And I wasn't intimating that it was a failed investment strategy, but the realities are that the market has not performed. And I think we ought to stop fooling ourselves by saying if suddenly we had a 45% return, everything would be okay. That isn't going to happen, and we need to deal with the here and now and not what might occur somewhere in a land far away if we wanted to get back to a performance level that was acceptable.
Chair Butler, may I respond briefly?
Please, please.
I mentioned the large return, in fact, for exactly the opposite reason.
Well,
as Chair Butler knows, we have done five-year forecasts that suggest that even if we had returns of 10% or more consistently year after year, we would still end up after 5 years with a deficit. And we have argued in testimony that expectations of these kind of performances are unrealistic. And while you can never say they can't happen, occasionally they've happened in the history of the capital markets, we think it's a very bad bet. And the reason that I mentioned the 36% and the 45% to 55% is exactly for the reason that you say this is something that is, you can't ever say it can't happen, but it is so incredulous that it is not a good foundation on which to plan policy going forward.
Thank you.
So
that's
I am in absolutely in accord with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. I mean, the first is you were talking about the dream of what it would take to not be showing a deficit. What does it take, basically, to stop the bleeding, in a sense?
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, I don't know what stop the bleeding is, but let me propose a definition of stop the bleeding. That is that we stop the UAL from growing. And what that would take would be consistent returns in the portfolio of 8%, which means returns in the stock market of somewhat more, in the order of 9% to 10%, for 26 years. And the reason I picked 26 years is that that's our amortization period. And if we earned our assumed rate for 26 years, then the rates that we are about to put into place in July of 2003 would pay for the ongoing liabilities of the fund as they grow, as well as make up for the deficit. So if that's I propose that as a sample definition of stop the bleeding, I think that a lot of stakeholders would find that still an unpalatable set of circumstances, but it takes at least 8% to stop the increase in rates from going forward. In fact, it takes a little bit more than that.
Okay.
Is that responsive, sir?
Yes, thank you. Jim, let me make sure that we understand that can't be the plan, or it isn't the plan at present, because the plan at present actually allows for a few years of respite, at which point then the employers start making up or mandatorily assess the UAL, the deficiency, to bring it back. So, and that, Senator Devlin, is probably the stopgap plan from allowing this to continue out. And those are issues that legislatively, as Mr. Voitko has indicated, legislatively we'd have to address. Now, Senator Devlin, is that responsive? Then please,
yes,
follow up.
The combination of returns that came back to, let's say, more historical levels, because your historical levels would, and the combination of legislative changes in the system, I mean, that's just more of a statement than a question, should lead to some reduction in that unfunded liability, at least some showing of improvement, I would think.
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, a return to historical returns would not do much to diminish the UAL, because historical returns are what's expected
But in addition to that, if there's legislative changes as anticipated.
And Senator Devlin, that is correct. So far, only one has been enacted into law, HB 2001, that I'm aware of, and I believe the signing ceremony is shortly. And it does have a modest reduction, but an appreciable one. But as Chair Butler, I know, who sits on the first committee on the House side, knows, we're anticipating rates will climb over the course of the next 4 years quickly into the mid-20% level before pickup. And things like 2001 or HB 2004, which are under consideration, make noticeable changes in that, but none of them in aggregate, again, would take the rates below 20% once the smoothing period has reached its climax.
Final question. Follow-up. Yes, Senator, please.
What's the long-term impact on the liabilities of the system? It's difficult to tell how much. I know it's not a large portion, but it's in the variable account of continuing losses to that account. In terms of, I would assume that the people that have a portion in the variable have lost, just like most people in the private sector, have lost, roughly 35-36% of the value of that in the last 3 years.
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, the effect of the variable is complicated. Let me give you a couple examples. For those retirees who have remained exposed to the variable when their benefit stream is reduced on the margin to reflect the losses in the variable account, the expense of future COLA increases on their benefit go down, so there's a benefit to the fund, although it's relatively modest because most retirees are not exposed to variable. In the among active employees, there is somewhat of the same effect, but again, there's not enough money in the variable account. I believe member dollars in the variable account are no more than $1 billion or so.
Yeah.
So it's nowhere near as powerful, for example, as the Tier 1 return guarantee. But there are some positive changes for the fiscal footprint of the fund with respect to its liabilities, but I don't want to overplay them either.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The only question I had, Jim, and I know that it's a very complex issue, but the Tier 1 regular account earnings available at a negative 8.17 as compared to the variable account losses at 21.3, is that a difference in the decisions of the Investment Council, the Oregon Investment Council? Is that what that is?
Chair Butler, that's really a less that than it is a how the variable fund is defined in statute. The variable fund defined in statute is 100% exposure to U.S. domestic stocks. And so that you see there reflected the performance of 100% investment in U.S. domestic stocks. And that's in statute. That's not a choice of the OIC. The regular fund did much better than that because over 35% of its assets are invested in fixed income, which actually had a very positive return, offsetting the decline in stocks, real estate, which had a positive return, and to a lesser extent, private equity, which did not. But the bottom line is that the regular fund is highly diversified and has offsetting positive investments during certain circumstances like these. The variable fund, by definition, is 100% stocks.
Okay, thank you very much. Further questions of Director Voitko? Thank you very much for presentation of your report. And unless there's objections, we'll go ahead and acknowledge the receipt of that report by this committee. Objections? So ordered. Thank you very much. Well, now, thank you, Dallas. Oh, and let's see, UAL. I'll buy that acronym. I don't know how many times it was used, but I used it a couple of times. Representative Johnson, you're the keeper of the kitty here.
Absolutely, I'd say a buck's worth, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much. And the rules are that has now been purchased, and UAL belongs to me. I can use it any time I want. Continuing on. We'll now convene the subcommittee of the subcommittee on Senate Bill 5543 for the Secretary of State's office. Setting some ground rules. You know what the piggy bank is for. I've had to get nailed on it this morning already. That's for acronyms, and you're welcome to buy them all you want. It goes to the American Cancer Society. I'm still protesting the lack of the consumption of beef in the state of Oregon. You'll see me wear my beef, it's what's for dinner hat, and where's the beef? My constituents in Harney County are probably the most affected, where I have a great number of cattle producers and beef producers out in that country, with the other issues that we're concerned about with water and so forth, we've got to continue to remember those folks. So I wear my where's the beef hat until we can address some of those issues in this legislative assembly. And my wife says I cannot go to bed with it on anymore, however I can continue to shower in it. So with that, we will go ahead and invite Secretary of State forward. Mr. Secretary of State, it's an honor to have you here. We're privileged to have your presence today.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I have with me today Marion Hammond, who's my press assistant, communications assistant, who will do a marvelous job of helping communicate on the wall with the in-focus projector. So, I have one question for you, Mr. Chair, which is, now that you own the UAL acronym, would you be kind enough to tell us what it means?
Unfunded actuarial liability, for the record, and that should have been entered in the record. That's why we originally started putting a price on acronyms, and so that the record would be complete with full words as opposed to acronyms, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you used it, and I bought it, so you owe the kitty.
Uh-oh. Wait, owe the kitty a dollar?
No, please proceed. Karen actually is keeping track of how much you'll owe.
This committee is tantamount to highwaymen.
spoken from the author of herself.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, it's a real pleasure to be here today, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about the Secretary of State's agency. I'm going to spend about the next 30 minutes or so giving you a general overview of the Secretary of State's agency, our programs, our services, and our budget. And then after I'm done, the division directors will each talk in much greater detail about their divisions, and they'll be happy to answer your very specific questions about the division. And in addition, I'd obviously be happy to answer any questions you have for me at the end of this presentation. So I want to start with a very broad look at the mission and the structure of the Secretary of State's agency. So the first question is, what is our agency's purpose? Well, as citizens, we expect our government to be honest, accountable, and democratic, with a small d. The Secretary of State's office plays a unique and critical role in ensuring state government meets these expectations. We ensure that government is honest by auditing public accounts. We ensure that government is accountable by administering all public records and making them available to the public. And we ensure that government is democratic by running elections effectively, accurately, and efficiently, and by enforcing election laws. Now, all of our work is guided by a general mission statement that we've created for our agency. And the mission statement reads, the mission of the Secretary of State's office is to provide stewardship of public resources by facilitating access to government information and records, ensuring that public dollars are well spent, offering registration services to businesses and consumers, safeguarding the democratic process and overseeing state lands for the Common School Fund. Right, and with the newest addition to our office, the Cultural Trust, the final piece of our mission statement is advancing cultural opportunities for all Oregonians. So there are a total of 9 divisions in the agency, and you can see our general organization chart here. And as I said, the directors will each talk in detail about their divisions later today and tomorrow. For now, I'd like to briefly summarize the role each division plays in fulfilling the mission of the Secretary of State's office. So we start with the executive office. The executive office provides leadership, policy guidance, coordination, and daily management of the diverse programs of the Secretary of State's office. We develop strategic plans and legislative initiatives, handle media relations, and serve as liaison with the other constitutional officers and the legislature. My staff also responds to thousands of public inquiries about state government each year. The next division is the audits division. Their mission is auditing to protect the public interest and improve Oregon government. The audits division carries out the Secretary of State's constitutional and statutory responsibility to audit the financial condition and operations of state agencies. Our auditors determine whether agencies' operations are in compliance with applicable laws and regulations. The archives division has a mission that is to identify and make accessible the valuable records of Oregon government, to reduce the expense of record keeping at all levels of government, and to publish the Oregon Administrative Rules and the Oregon Blue Book, both electronically and in print. The Corporations Division assists the public in registering business entities and secured transactions and commissioning notaries public and investigating notary complaints. The division also administers the Business Information Center, which provides information needed to start a business in Oregon. By statute, the Secretary of State is the state's chief election officer. The Elections Division maintains the uniform interpretation and application of election laws among the 36 county clerks, produces elections manuals for topics including campaign finance, candidates, and initiative and referendum, investigates election law violations and administers penalties, and publishes and distributes the state's voters pamphlet for primary, general, and special statewide elections. Now, another division is the Business Services Division. And the Business Services Division provides central business and accounting functions for the entire Secretary of State's agency. And it's comprised of 4 sections, including accounting, budget, purchasing, and deposit interface. And then the Cultural Trust is a new division. It's the 2001 legislature created the Oregon Cultural Trust to address the long-standing problem of a lack of funding for Oregon's art, heritage, and humanities. By 2012, our goal is to create a stable and permanent source of funding for culture in Oregon. As the endowment is built over the next decade, we also plan to distribute grant funds to local communities and tribes throughout the state.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Bradbury, I never completely understood why it was that the Cultural Trust was housed in the Secretary of State's office. When I look at the fact that we have an Arts Commission, we have a Heritage Commission, we have agencies that are charged with that sphere of responsibilities, why did the Cultural Trust end up with you?
I would never presume to speak for the legislature because it was a legislative decision, but it was from the discussions I've had with members of the legislature, it was clear to me that there was a desire to have some, ideally they'd have the governor but they felt that the governor really had way too many other responsibilities and would not be able to dedicate the time. And so the decision, as I understand it, was to have another statewide officer become the head of the cultural trust. So that's my understanding, is because I'm a statewide elected official.
Thank you.
I think Representative Johnson thought it maybe would go to Scappoose area or something like that.
I think that's a fabulous idea, Mr. Chair.
A lot of culture up there.
The another division within the Secretary of State's agency is the Personnel Resources Division. The Personnel Resources Division provides human resource services and advice and assistance in the interpretation and application of state and federal laws and policies.
A great deal of interface between this personnel resources and DAS personnel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
And the final division within the Secretary of State's office is the information system. And as our public and private customers become more sophisticated in their use of information, so must the Secretary of State's office become more sophisticated in how we manage and distribute information. The division prides itself on providing infrastructure at minimal cost, and they provide business process improvement assistance, technology planning, project management, systems maintenance services, and purchasing and support for desktop systems.
Again, Secretary, excuse me, just a moment, Mr. Secretary, but I'm probably sensitive to this because we have just been hearing the Department of Administrative Services. They have a rather substantial information services. Is there a great deal of interface between your information systems and their organization?
A huge amount of interface, and I will talk a little bit more about that in some of the success stories.
Thank you.
All nine divisions of the Secretary of State's office work together to ensure that we are an efficient agency that provides the best possible service to the public at the lowest possible cost. Now, as the chief auditor, as the state's chief auditor, the Secretary of State's office audits public accounts to ensure that agencies are operating efficiently and not wasting public dollars. We believe that it's important to set a good example within our own agency, and we're constantly revising our programs and services to make them more efficient. Some of the cost control measures we employ include staff reductions, careful purchasing practices, including thorough market research and solicitation of competitive bids, and sound contract administration. We also constantly review our staff deployment and implement changes necessary to maximize efficiency. And finally, our most effective cost reduction tool is the implementation of new technologies. Now, I'd like to summarize a few of the organizational changes that our agency has made in the past decade to improve our performance and efficiency. As this graph shows, we've already taken significant steps to streamline the agency over the past decade. In a time when many other agencies were expanding their budgets, we were looking for ways to streamline. The agency you see before you today is very lean. We have cut almost 20 positions in the past 10 years. We've also significantly reduced the ratio of management to staff over the past decade. Managers represented 27% of FTE in 1991, and managers represent 15% of FTE in 2003. Next, I'll cover some of the ways that our agency has used information technology to increase our service to the public and reduce their costs. We've seen dramatic benefits from the application of appropriate information technology in recent years. And these benefits include reduced operating costs, improved employee efficiency and productivity, and increased ability to fulfill our agency's mission. many of our agency's services used to be available only through a phone call or a visit to one of our divisions. Now the public can access a vast array of our programs and information online at their own convenience. You can see a list of many of those online programs on this slide. And I'd like to highlight a few of our agency's online successes. We're very excited to be the pilot agency for the state's e-commerce effort. We are the first state agency to successfully implement online credit card payments through our new e-pay system. We developed the system in conjunction with the Department of Administrative Services. This collaboration included careful project management and thorough testing and troubleshooting. Our successful development of the e-pay system has paved the way for other state agencies to use the system. E-commerce applications like the e-pay system provide significant benefits to the public and to the agency. E-commerce makes our services more convenient for users. The public can access our services when and where it's convenient for them. And e-commerce applications also reduce manual processes and make our administration more efficient. E-commerce applications are employed by two divisions in the Secretary of State's office. First, the public can give donations to the Cultural Trust online. And second, businesses can renew their business registrations online. Here you see a screenshot of the Cultural Trust online donation page. In only 4 months from project inception to completion, ISD and the Cultural Trust were able to create Oregon's first online donation option for gifts to the trust during December of 2002. It was a real success. Of the $1.65 million raised by the Cultural Trust in December of 2002, over $500,000, or one-third, of the funds were donated through online transactions on the Trust's website. Now, our corporation division has also been able to make use of technology to dramatically improve the convenience of services it provides to the public. All businesses in Oregon are required to register their business name with the Secretary of State's Corporation Division. The division maintains the information in its business entity registration and information system, which is the only statewide centralized database of businesses in Oregon. Last biennium, we completed a two-year project to migrate Barry to the web. The database has now been online and accessible to the public for 2 successful years. A lot of people are using the database. In fact, there are about 271,000 online searches every month. Now that the public can access the information online, calls to the Business Information Center have reduced by almost 50%, allowing OSCI to reduce call center staff from 17 to 8. Online Barry also paves the way for future e-government, including centralizing business registration. Oregonians can also conduct uniform commercial code lien searches online. Again, this increases convenience for users and increases the efficiency of the system. There are about 22,000 online searches conducted on this UCC site each month. The Business Services Division also has applied information technology to improve our contract bidding process. With our online bid site, vendors can log on to the site and review any bid requests from the Secretary of State. They can review open bids, bid results, and bid awards. And they can register to receive updates for any and all bids automatically. This system makes contracting and purchasing more convenient for vendors and more efficient for the agency. Eventually, our goal is to make it possible for vendors to submit bids and proposals online. This will save a great deal of time, paper, and postage for the agency. Now I'd like to highlight a few of the Elections Division's applications of technology. This slide shows a screenshot of the online initiative referendum and referral log. All initiatives and referenda are available on this searchable database. The site includes links to measure text, ballot title comments, draft and certified ballot titles, and Supreme Court opinions. There are about 2,700 searches per month on the initiative referendum and referral log. And this is only just the beginning. The IR&R log paves the way for future e-government enhancements in the Elections Division, such as the proposed CNE database, which would also be online, accessible to the public, and searchable. You can see here that visits to the Oregon Votes website, I just skipped a page. We have a site called the Oregon Votes website. The Oregon Votes website gives you information about how you can find a ballot drop site, how you can find your election office. It has an online voter registration form that you can actually download off the web and then send in. So it's a whole series of information that's available to voters. And you can see here that the Oregon Votes website visits to the site dramatically increase around election time, which is a great sign that our Oregonians are using this valuable resource for information about voting. The Archives Division provides online service to the many Oregonians who are interested in their genealogy through the Archives Name Index. The database contains over 400,000 genealogical records, all entered and maintained by volunteers. And I don't think you can get much more cost-effective than that, to have 400,000 names entered by volunteers.
Senator Winters, recognized.
Chair, which volunteer organization is responsible for this activity?
I'm sorry, what?
Is there a volunteer organization that's responsible for that activity?
For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roy Turnbull, and I'm the state archivist. There's no organization that's responsible. These are simply people who have been users, they're interested in genealogy, and they come in and donate their time and energy to help create this.
Do you keep a roster of people, or if I was interested, what would I need to do to volunteer my time, my services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, you would contact us, and the head of the archives section would have you come over for a visit to show you what we're talking about. And then you'd fill out a form, and we'd send it to our personnel division, sign you up, and put you to work.
Any training involved in that process?
Mr. Chair, the training is essentially being able to read 19th century penmanship, stuff like that, and then fill out online forms. So it's not absolutely untrained, but it's the kind of thing that people acquire as they do it. They get better at it.
These are old records, then, that exist in the archives, then? Is that what these are?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So, actually, the volunteers are searching through pages of the old records from the 19th century and then extracting that information and putting it into computer format.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
There's only one service that I would offer to you that might be a little less expensive and more beneficial to the state, and that is that I understand that there's a genealogical, International Genealogical Society in Salt Lake City that will come and take complete copies of all the records, return to the state of Oregon a complete microfilmed copy of all of your records, and then provide for you all of the information in final form suitable for genealogical research. So you wouldn't have to spend any time with the training, and those folks can extract it, and it'll be in uniform format under a program where they've already trained their volunteers.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of like one of those real slow pitches that you get every now and then. We work with them. They're already in our building, microfilming records.
Wonderful.
That are on our list. The records that I refer to tend to be records that typically are not addressed by that program.
Okay.
That contain a lot of names, dates, and places that genealogists find valuable. So we're really doing both right
Great.
Now.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Colonel.
So those are just a few of the ways that our agency has improved our service to the public, increased staff efficiency, and decreased cost. Now I'd like to turn the discussion of how the Secretary of State's office contributes to the success of the state at large. The Progress Board links our office to two specific benchmarks. We are the lead agency for Benchmark 31, which relates to voter turnout, and we are the primary link agency for Benchmark 35, which relates to public management quality. Our office plays a unique role in helping Oregon achieve these benchmarks. We create the foundation that makes it possible for other agencies and members of the public to improve Oregon's benchmark performance. And let me just explain a little bit further. Our elections division ensures that elections are run efficiently, accurately, and effectively, and in doing so, we increase voter confidence in the electoral system or the process. By providing information about registering and voting through the voter's pamphlet and on our website, we increase voters' knowledge about the process. And this creates the foundation for increased voter turnout. Now let's look at Benchmark 35, which is, as I said, public management quality. Our auditors examine whether public agencies are spending their money legally, effectively, and wisely, and recommend appropriate changes.
Senator Winters is recognized. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Bill, I know that you do the audits and you recommend changes. Do you also have a follow-up component to see if those changes have been made? Or if once recommendations are made in your audit report, is that the end of your role as the Secretary of State, or is there some follow-up activity?
Kevin, you want to answer that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Polino, Director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. Part of our audit standards require us, when we go back to an agency, to do a follow-up of prior recommendations. And so for those agencies that we're at every single year, we do go back in and look at recommendations to see whether they're implemented. Unfortunately, some agencies we don't get back to for quite a while. And so we are currently changing our process so that we can do a little bit better job of following up on those recommendations. The difficult thing for us is that we have no authority to make agencies do anything. We can only make recommendations, and it's up to them to implement.
I'm aware of that. I guess where I'm trying to go is where you have repeated problems within the agency, the same offense over and over again. We should be talking about as a legislative body, but if it takes you a while to get back to the agency, then that creates a whole other issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, I agree with you. Unfortunately for us, all we can do is continue to point out the problems. Corrective action is really out of our
hands. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. What is your audit cycle of agencies? How many within a year, 2 years, or what is the cycle?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, some agencies, most of the larger ones, we're at every single year. Some agencies, small agencies, boards and commissions, we do not get to unless a problem comes up.
And we will get to the audit division in full. To Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to give this. A long time ago when we were discussing audits and the Secretary of State, I mean, I wasn't discussing with the current Secretary of State, but the former. I thought about the idea, and I didn't think it would go well with the governor. When you say you have your authority is limited in directing agencies, I was questioning whether or not there's a state where they give a Secretary of Authority to Secretary of State the authority to request your funds.
I'm not aware of any, but you know, certainly something would be interesting for
sure. I was assured that it would be a shot across the bow to the chief executive if I introduced
Kathy, did you want to make a comment?
Quick comment on that. Oregon is a little bit different than most states because some audit organizations are actually part of the legislature. And so they're legislative auditors, and there's a little bit more of authority there for those states than what we have here in Oregon.
That does create an interesting opportunity, however, to work more closely between the legislature and the Secretary of State's office.
And we have a very good working relationship. The audits division, the Secretary of State's audits division, maintains a good working relationship with your legislative audit committee, and there are projects that they work on jointly. So, just to summarize on the auditing, the audits that were conducted by our office between 1995 and 2002 identified over $131 million in all funds savings that could be achieved if all of our audit recommendations were followed. So once again, our audits are creating the foundation for agencies to improve their performance, and because the Secretary of State's office is a non-regulatory agency, as has been said, we can't force state agencies to implement the changes that we suggest. We have to rely on the collaboration of other agencies to help us meet the benchmark for public management quality. I'd like to talk about one other benchmark, and that's benchmark 37, state arts funding. As a new program, the Cultural Trust is not linked with any of the benchmarks in the 2002 Progress Report because it just was created during that time period. However, the trust will play a significant role in benchmark 37, state's arts funding. Oregon has historically ranked at or near the bottom of arts funding nationwide. This benchmark calls for improving Oregon's ranking from 46th, which is our current ranking, to 31st by 2010. The Cultural Trust was created by the 2001 legislature as a long-range plan to address this benchmark. The Cultural Trust 2002 inaugural campaign was a tremendous success. The trust received contributions from more than 4,400 individuals and businesses in Oregon. It raised over $1.65 million in private gifts, matched by equal contributions made directly to cultural nonprofits. I'm sure that you all have questions about the trust since it's a new program, but rest assured, Ross McKean, who's the trust's interim director, will be talking about the trust in much greater detail tomorrow. Now that you at least have an overview of the services of our agency that we provide to the public and the ways we contribute to the success of Oregon government, it's time to talk about the hard stuff, which is the budget cuts.
And with that, Mr. Secretary, I'm going to turn the gavel to Representative Johnson, and with your indulgence, I'm going to step down for just a few moments. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Secretary, please continue.
So the division in our agency that will be hit hardest by general fund cuts is the Elections Division. Elections is funded almost entirely by general funds, and the division has already received significant budget cuts. And there's been no reduction in workload or statutory responsibilities for the Elections Division. In fact, demands have either remained constant or increased with less money to meet those demands. One of the factors that has increased cost in elections is Oregonians' increased interest and participation in the initiative and referendum process. In recent years, we've seen increases in the number of initiatives and referendums submitted to the Elections Division, the public focus on the initiative signature verification process, and the number of complaints submitted to the division regarding possible violations of election laws, particularly complaints involving initiatives and referendums. The 2000 election difficulties in Florida also increased public expectations of the elections process. There is now more attention to the elections process, and problems are more apparent within it. Federal election reform is one of the direct results of this recent increase in attention to the elections process. Congress passed the Help America Vote Act in October of 2002, requiring sweeping reforms to the nation's voting process. HAVA mandates include replacement of punch card and lever voting systems, creation of a centralized voter registration system, new voter registration identification requirements, and requirements that we provide voters with disabilities the same opportunity for privacy and independence that we give to non-disabled voters.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
Equal voting access for people with disabilities, given that we now vote by mail, how onerous is that responsibility for the Secretary of State's office to discharge?
Basically,
people are voting in their kitchens.
Basically, the election plan that's being developed to meet these mandates speaks to having two what are called DREs, digital recording equipment, DRE voting machines in each county. That they're remarkable machines that exist now. That you know, if you can't speak, depending on your disability, if you can't write or whatever, you can use a straw, you can blow through a tube, and I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can have people voting privately without. Right now, we send two people out. If you have a disability, we send two people out, a Democrat and a Republican, and they go through the ballot with you. So those two people know how you voted. So there's not the privacy that the federal law requires. So these digital recording, these digital voting machines will enable disabled people to vote privately and not have other people know how they vote. And, you know, it would be onerous if it wasn't for the fact that the federal government does appear to be paying for the mandates that they're now putting on us.
Including the devices, the machines?
Yeah, they will pay for those, right.
And they would be located at the county seat or in some public accommodation that was ADA and...
And it would be good to have John Lindback talk more at length about this. My impression is one will be mobile and one will be at the county, in each county. But I'd probably better let him tell you for sure. So the federal act is really a tremendous opportunity to bring federal dollars to Oregon. In fact, it's estimated that HAVA will provide about $43 million in federal funding to our state. Some of these funds do, in fact, require a state match, and we'll be working with the legislature to put the necessary structure in place so that we can get those wonderful federal funds from on high.
Mr. Secretary, one other question. I don't know in what context I think I know this, but I believe that there's a sense of urgency for the state of Oregon to do certain things in order to qualify for a really magnificent federal grant to help implement the Help America Vote Act. Could you share with the committee a little bit about what all the legislature will need to do in order to respond to the federal mandates?
The first thing that needs to be done, that's already in process in the legislature, is the enactment of a bill that creates a separate election fund, where the interest that fund earns goes back into that fund, and that bill is already moved out of House rules and is currently in Ways and Means somewhere. That would, we, our goal is to have that fund created sometime in the next month. And that would be the first step. And the first money that comes from the federal act is not specifically tied to the mandates. I went through a whole series of mandates, get rid of punch cards, et cetera. Those all have to be implemented over a certain period of time with the federal funds helping us.
Right now, are we in jeopardy, we, Oregon, in jeopardy because we're not moving quickly enough, or are we on target?
As long as the bill that came out of House rules and is now in this committee, as long as that bill moves in a reasonably efficient fashion, we're in great shape. We are, in fact, ahead of a lot of other states. Now, and John Lindback will be here tomorrow and will be talking about it, talking about this in much greater detail, because it obviously is a huge deal for our elections division. Finally, one of the significant cost factors in the election division is, in fact, the voter's pamphlet. The size of the voter's pamphlet is determined by the unlimited number of candidates, measures, and measure arguments submitted by campaigns and individuals. This makes it impossible to accurately predict the size of future voter's pamphlets for budgeting purposes. Voters' pamphlet fees currently cover only 25% of the cost to produce the voters' pamphlet, and the remaining 75% comes out of the general fund. On this slide, you can see a pie chart demonstrating the cost breakdown for the last two general elections. General election voters' pamphlets always have the highest cost because the number of pages needed for candidates and measure arguments as well. Now, as you know, the governor's proposed budget reduces our agency's general fund budget by about $1.9 million. Secretary of State's office is already a lean agency, as I showed in earlier slides, and we just can't simply squeeze existing programs to meet the required $1.9 million reduction. We've got to cut programs in their entirety if we're going to meet the $1.9 cut. The voters' pamphlet makes up 1.8 million of our 2003-2005 budget. Our proposal to meet the governor's balanced budget is to eliminate the voters' pamphlet in its current form. We firmly believe that this is really our most responsible option. Fulfilling our constitutional responsibilities and enforcing the law is more important than continuing the subsidy of political campaigns with the voters' pamphlet. And as I said, John will talk about this in a great deal more detail during his presentation. The bottom line is that during a crisis of government, it's more important than ever for the public to be assured that our elections are fair, public agencies are spending money legally and wisely, and the records of government are open for inspection. Now that concludes my overview presentation, and I'd be happy to answer your general questions before I talk briefly about the executive office as the first part of more detailed discussions of each division and having each of the directors here before you.
Any questions, Representative Devlin? Representative Devlin?
Mr. Secretary, on the voters' pamphlet and that estimate in terms of the cost of it, that's presuming that you'll have a voters' pamphlet, obviously at the primary and the general elections in the even number of years. Is there an assumption there that you'll have a voters' pamphlet in other elections, or would that be a separate, basically a separate appropriation, like when the legislature calls or refers something to the May ballot?
It would be better for John to answer this, but I'm pretty sure. Huh?
Okay,
great.
Okay. For the record, I'm Jean Strait, and I'm the director of the Business Services Division. And that budget appropriation that we're talking about is just for the general and the primary election. That's the only appropriation that we get in our budget. anything, any special elections are appropriated separately.
Right.
Follow-up, Senator Devlin?
I'll probably save the... I'll put this question on the record so you know it'll be asked when...
Okay.
What would the fees have to be adjusted to cover the cost of the voter's pamphlet? And are the counties paying their proportionate share of the cost in terms of their insertions into the voter's pamphlet?
I can answer those briefly. You'd have to multiply the fees by five. So the fees would go up times five. And that would pay the cost of the voter's pamphlet. And the counties pay entirely for their inserts into the voter's pamphlet.
And follow up.
Oh, Senator Devlin.
I understand this, that you think this is the most responsible thing to do in terms of to meet this budget objective of reducing by $1.9 million. Are the counties aware of this proposal yet, and have you had any reaction from the counties? Because obviously, without being able to piggyback on to the state voters' pamphlet, I think it would be more expensive for them to do their own, obviously.
I'm not sure I fully understand your question.
Well, Mr. Secretary, I was thinking in terms of if we eliminate the voters' pamphlet, effectively, we've eliminated the county's participation also, because for many of them to do the voters' pamphlet on their own would be much more expensive. Have we had any communications from the counties?
We have regular communications with the county clerks. I cannot say specifically that there's been a specific discussion about voters' pamphlets. But that would be for John to talk about tomorrow.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Mr. Secretary, one other question that John may touch on in greater detail tomorrow is I've had constituent concerns that through administrative rule, the Secretary of State's office has increased the cost for special districts filing in the voter's pamphlet, and I don't know whether that's accurate for candidates. I don't know whether that's accurate or if John could bring any additional information on that.
Yeah, no, John, I'm sure, we can...
If you'd ask him, that would be great.
My initial response is that there are no special districts in the state voters' pamphlet. There are no special district candidates in the state's voters' pamphlet. There may be... So John will have to answer that, because it may be county. Obviously, counties would do.
This would be like Tualatin Valley Search and Rescue that is multiple jurisdictions. I mean, it covers multiple counties, I think three.
Right.
But if he could bring some additional information on costs to those candidates to file for those positions, that would be great.
Right. We'll do it. And I just want to make one comment, which is that it always... when I was in the legislature, I was always a strong supporter of the general fund subsidy to the voters' pamphlet. I thought it made, it was a good thing to do. Here's the reality for me as a most recently as a statewide candidate. It cost me $1,000 to be in the voters' pamphlet for a statewide election. And that reached every voter in the state. And there was no other investment that I could make that was so inexpensive to reach that many voters. So my fee as a statewide candidate would go from $1,000 to $5,000, and it would still be the most cost-effective way to reach a large body of voters.
Thank you.
From a candidate standpoint.
I guess one other question. When you say that you're talking about eliminating the voter's pamphlet in its current form, and I'm trying to think of the number of people that I know who use the voter's pamphlet as an essential tool of informed voting. We're making huge accommodation on the one hand to make sure that people with a vast array of disabilities are able to vote and exercise their franchise, and yet on the other hand, it seems to me that we may be talking about changing a traditional tool that Oregonians have come to rely on rather dramatically. And if it goes online or if it comes to people in some other mechanism than the printed text, whether or not on the one hand you're increasing certain folks' accessibility to the polls and information necessary for them to cast a ballot. On the other hand, if people don't have computers, don't have access to getting the voter's pamphlet in another format, are they being deprived of information essential to an informed electorate?
Let me be real clear. In this budget presentation, I can't talk about the whole picture in terms of what I would really like to have happen with the voter's pamphlet is I'd like to end the general fund subsidy of the voter's pamphlet and pay for the voter's pamphlet through the fees that are assessed. I think it's critical that we continue to produce the voter's pamphlet.
In its current form, a written booklet that...
Yes, I think it needs, because not everybody can get online.
Right.
I mean, I don't think you solve it, and hey, it's, you know, your computer is in the desk, and a lot of people do read the voter's pamphlet in the morning when they're having breakfast, trying to figure out how they're going to, they do three measures of breakfast, right? I mean, so I think it's critical that it be produced, and I think that what we need to do is eliminate the general fund subsidy and have it paid for through fees, and that's very doable. It's a matter of changing the fee structure. So I'm a very strong supporter of the voters' pamphlet.
Then I may have made erroneously the leap to believe you were going to some kind of a different format than our traditional printed voters' pamphlet, and I apologize. Any other questions for the Secretary? Senator Devlin.
No. Okay.
Thank you. Okay. I want to talk to you briefly about the division, which is called the Executive Office. And the Executive Office supports my work in both constitutional and statutory responsibilities. And the Executive Office supports the agency in fulfilling division-specific missions. And the services of the Executive Office include providing policy direction and agency strategic planning, general oversight of the work of each of the divisions, coordinating work among the divisions, managing external contact, including relations with other governments, other agencies of state government, the legislature, the media, and our constituents. And the Executive Office also performs statutory functions not assigned to a division, such as lending the state flag. This is a critical function I'm sure you didn't know happened. Lending the state flag. And we also want to accept and file the original bills that you pass during the legislative session, just so you know. Earlier, I described the role of the Secretary of State's office in ensuring that our government is honest, accountable, and democratic, and with a small d. And a significant part of my role as Secretary of State is speaking to Oregonians about issues and their values, and values like citizenship and appreciation for our past and accountability of government. And this is an important function of the Executive Office. So when we talk about funding for the Executive Office is funded by a general fund, other fund split. The division percentage of this funding is 29% other funds and 71% general funds, with a total biennial budget of approximately $1.4 million, supporting six FTE, including me. And the other funds portion of the funding is an internal assessment to all divisions of the agency. So we have three POPs within the Executive Office. POP 110, this program option package will move the funding for all positions of the Cultural Trust, which is two, to other funds. The POP also will reclassify the executive director of the Cultural Trust. So that's POP 110.
Mr. Secretary,
yes.
Reclassify from what to what?
It's from...
Do you know what it is?
Well, it's to the principal exec manager F, but I don't know what the current... Mr. Olson?
I believe it's at... it's either D or E. I believe it might be E.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And then, in that case, well, I should just explain briefly. That came up because the Cultural Trust Board, which is a whole group of citizens around the state, felt very strongly that we needed to have a really well-paid executive director for the Cultural Trust. So that's where that came. And we went through quite a process with them to try to work with the state policies and also meet their needs. So then the next POP 111, is this program option package will establish the Oregon Cultural Trust as a separate division of the agency. Currently, the trust is established as a section of the executive office. And the current organization complicates accounting for funds that are separate from the executive office. So we'd just like to create it as a separate division. There's no cost associated with that POP. Then POP 112, this program option package will reclassify two existing positions. And they're both in the executive office, and the positions have been performing the duties of the new classifications since January of 2001, and both positions are funded with 56% other fund and 44% general fund monies. The other fund is an internal assessment to the agency divisions. And I can certainly talk about those two. One is moving from a principal executive manager D to a principal executive manager G. And the other is moving from executive support specialist 1 to public information representative 2. And Marion is our public information representative 2. And that those would be those two. Those would be the two reclassifications that are in the POP.
Any questions of the Secretary? Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
So who's next? Roy.
I can move this.
Yes, you can move that, yes.
Short.
Okay.
Would you be more comfortable switching to another chair?
I don't know. I'm 6 feet 3 inches tall, and I feel like my chin is coming up.
Problem there. Completely foreign to me, but perhaps you might.
Deeply appreciated.
See, now I got the good chair.
Better?
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Roy Turnbaugh, and I'm the state archivist, and I'm here to tell you briefly what we do at the state archives, what some of the serious challenges that we're facing are, and explain elements of our budget and answer any questions that you might have. And I'll try and be brief. The Archives Division has three sections, and those sections are, first of all, publications, second, archives, and third, records management. The publications section publishes the annual Oregon Administrative Rules compilation, which is a 16-volume, 10,000-page paper compilation that's also available free of charge online. It publishes the Oregon Bulletin, which is a monthly publication that contains the text of all new amended emergency rules. And again, This is available free of charge online. And it publishes the biannual Oregon Blue Book, both in paper for sale and distribution to a list of complimentary recipients, and again online. I should note that the online Oregon Blue Book is updated daily, so we do try and keep that current. Publications does all this with a staff of three. One of the challenges that we face is to use technology in an inexpensive way to facilitate the publication process and to reduce its expense. We measure the success in doing that by the ease and success agencies have when they're filing their rules, the ease that impacted parties have in accessing the relevant rules and notices, the accuracy and timeliness of all of our publications, and the amount of inquiries that we receive through the Blue Book. Okay, so that's the first of three sections. The second section is the archives itself, and that does what most people traditionally assume a government archives does. And we identify and preserve the permanently valuable records of Oregon government at all levels, both state and local. We make those records accessible to the public pursuant to the law. Our heaviest users are government itself, the legal community, and genealogists and family historians. Secretary Bradbury mentioned, and then I answered some questions about the 400,000 name database our volunteers have compiled. This serves as an entry point to records in our custody that enable users to serve themselves for easy, if time-consuming, requests. Chair has moved. Okay. We make as much information as we can available over the Internet, such as full-text minutes of legislative committee hearings, inventories of county records, students' examples of historic documents, color images of the original Constitution, and so forth. The biggest single challenge for the archives section is to preserve and provide access to the records of Oregon government that are created and live in electronic form. As you may be aware, digital media are notoriously impermanent, and the means of providing access to them become technologically obsolete at a very rapid rate. A second challenge is to continue our course of making resources available to users over the Internet so that the staff can then deal with difficult and complex reference demands. And the third section of the division is records management. This section deals with the life cycle of government records, state and local. It authorizes the retention and disposition of public records, whatever the physical format is, whether it's paper, microfilm, sound recording, or digital. It identifies records that have permanent value and arranges transfer to the archives. It operates the State Records Center, which is inexpensive, well-managed warehouse space for over 70,000 cubic feet of inactive state agency records, well in excess of 70 million pieces of paper. It operates a security microfilm depository, which provides an environmentally controlled, secure, and well-managed space for over 250,000 rolls of valuable microfilm. The challenges that face records management are enormously difficult. The rush to digitize public records has not done away with paper, as you're probably aware this morning. Rather, it's added electronic versions of government records to paper ones. The so-called paperless office never appeared. What did appear are offices that bulge with paper, that have computers that are bulging with digital records.
And unfortunately, government's still at the early end of the learning curve in discovering that much of what its computers create and store are in fact really public records by law and require management. The solutions to these problems are managerial and technological. We've been pursuing both avenues. We use web-based training so that state and local governments can access it when convenient, so that we can minimize our travel costs. We're working with DAS facilities to close rented agency record storage and consolidate it in the State Record Center. We're working with DAS IRMD to build records management into a statewide content management system. We work with other states in the National Archives to assess approaches to electronic records management that are being tested. We're working with the Census Bureau to test software that enables simultaneous use of data from multiple locations. The cost of not managing public records is a high one. Need for storage, both digital and paper, keeps expanding. Access and accountability slip as records aren't managed, not because of any malicious intent, but because information is chaotic and records custodians tend to be confused and unskilled. Essential records are lost or destroyed. Trivial ones are kept indefinitely. The consequences are incalculable. Money comes to the division from a variety of sources. The State Record Center charges agencies for storage and management. This charge is substantially less than that found in the private sector. The Oregon Blue Book is primarily funded through sales receipts. The Oregon Administrative Rules are funded by sales receipts and by the general fund. Records management services to state and local governments are funded by the general fund. The archives is primarily funded by the general fund, although receipts for services fund supplies and services. Our biggest single expense outside of employees is rent. We will pay $1.3 million in rent next biennium, a sum that works out to over $75,000 for every person who works in our building. We have one program option packages, and that is to shift funding for four employees from exclusively general fund to a mix of general fund and other fund. The purpose of this, quite simply, is to reduce the strain on the general fund, to use money that we have generated from receipts, and to keep our employees so our programs can continue to function. That really concludes what I've prepared. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions for the State Archivist or the Secretary of State?
No, just a comment. Can I have a comment, Mr. Chief? I just know that records are very important. As a person who one time thought she was going to be a medical record librarian, I appreciate your role and function, but I'm often glad now that I did not become a medical record librarian. The industry has changed tremendously since the handling of paper, and now you're into from microfilming to I think that was the next step after paper. Now you're electronic and high tech, but it is, I don't think most people understand how valuable records are, and particularly in keeping documents for not only research, but the genealogy piece of it is very valuable. So I understand, and I also understand, I don't know, you still have to have certain temperatures now anymore in your building. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, we do, for paper and film, to keep them stable over long periods of time. We do. I want to thank you for the kind words and the perceptive comment. And I'll also point out that Secretary Bradbury is hosting a reception for the legislature at the Archives Building on March 5th.
and hope you'll be able to make it. We're going to have tours so we can show people more specifically what I'm talking about, which tends to be a little bit abstract if you don't see it, you know, in a tangible form.
We do receive often complaints from the public because they don't know about why and what exists. Particularly, they thought that the building itself was a little spindy and what have you. But I do understand the need for preservation of the record. And it's kind of interesting. We never think about the record until it's something that we need. And I was familiar with it. You have to have certain temperatures for certain documents and that kind of stuff.
Senator Winters, thank you again. You will see when you come to the building that the public areas are the ones that cause all the stir. The areas that the staff works in, the storage areas, are really pretty Spartan.
Everything's no longer, everything's out of the old building.
That's correct.
That was ready to fall apart then. Have you ever seen the old building? It was pretty old. I mean, if you sent staff to try to find something in the old place, it was pretty much more than just talking about treasure hunt. It was rather difficult to find things the old days. So
I would invite you all to come, obviously come to the, we're doing a little after work reception at the Archives building, but also the State Record Center is pretty remarkable. It's where the short-term records are kept. Because there's a legal period of time, and it varies from record to record, but it's a legal period of time you have to keep records. So there's this whole marvelous warehouse. And they can find a record basically like that. If you tell them what agency it's from and kind of when it was, they can just...
What is our length of time for keeping agency records now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it really varies depending on the record. It varies from read and destroy to permanent and anything along that continuum. You know, there are some major categories, common categories like contracts, for example, or personnel records that all agencies create. But one of the things that
do we keep personnel records beyond the federal statutory limit, or do we keep them within that limit?
Senator Winters, I don't know what the federal statutory limit is. I know that we require them to be kept for 75 years.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think the Fed's that long. In fact, I know it isn't, because my personnel records at my business, I'm not required to keep them that long. I think it's 7 years.
Senator Winters, because of benefits and liabilities, a stripped down personal record for state employees is kept for that long. The notion, I think, when we worked out that retention with the Department of Administrative Services and PERS, was that in this case it was probably better to err on the side of prudence then slice it too much.
You may want to have, because 75 years, and I know our longevity table is 84. If you're coming to work for the state, most of us are in, it's rare that there are 18, most of them are in 20. So, 75 years from 20, that's 95 years. That may be a long time. You may want to, think that particular policy, particularly at some point. You begin, even with microfilming or what have you, you get to capacity issues as to what really is reasonable, even in light of PERS, and check with them. That seems like an awful long time to keep a...
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I couldn't agree more. I will note, though, that those records are kept on film and not in paper, so they do not present a problem of bulk storage.
At some point, microfilming also becomes a storage capacity from. We started microfilming when I was at the med school. Oh, I should quit dating myself. I'm going to stop doing it. Anyway, it was some time ago.
Who was president at the time? Oh, I won't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Williams, I'm going to
we're going to quit while we're ahead.
No, I'm going to take that as a legislative endorsement to reduce the retention on personnel records and go forth and
talk to the entities.
And tell them.
Yes. I think 100 years is a long time. You know, when a person is 100 years old, it's a long time to keep a record. I'm sure that a part of their consideration is to make sure that, you know, you have the beneficiary and those things intact. I'm sure that that's part of it. But, you know, if the spouse is the beneficiary, which that's where most of it is, then, you know, they should have had their benefits by then, I would think. So that's a discussion that I think you can have with the agency. Just trying to free up your capacity.
I had one broad question, actually. You're the state archivist. We do not have, actually, a state historian. Is that, in a sense, do you feel that's part of your role in the...
Mr. Chair, the work that we do in the Archives Division with government records has some impact on state history, and would be, I wouldn't want to mislead you on that, but what it really does, the work that we really do, is based on keeping the government of this state accountable to its citizens and preserving the rights of government and the rights of its citizens. History is a byproduct of that primary responsibility, I think.
What I was thinking of primarily is, in a sense of, from a historical context, is it does seem, I think you would be doing this work as part of your responsibilities, and I think you've already explained that, but is enabling someone to come back 30 or 40 years from now, 50 years from now, and maybe be able to examine what was happening in the Kitzhaber administration or what was happening in the Atiyah administration, so that the records were there that... because when some of those things are lost, I mean, particularly like you were giving examples of audio tapes or videotapes, you know, they're irreplaceable.
Mr. Chair, we're actually doing something that's kind of exciting, at least exciting if you happen to work in the archives world. And we might have different standards than the rest of the world, with the Kitzhaber records. And that is, we're not only taking the paper documentation from the governor's office, but we've acquired 25 gigabytes of email from the governor's office, as well as the governor's website, which we can then make accessible via our own website to our users. So it really is kind of a whole new world with the mix of information out there, and it, like I said, it's exciting for us to deal with.
Mr. Chair, this building at one time did enjoy, from this right. political side, Cecil Edwards, who was the historian. But there has been no one who has come forward who have become the designated historian in this building since Cecil. For the archivist to, part of Cecil's being the historian was being involved in what was going on in the day-to-day activity at the state capitol. And I agree that somehow we've lost that part of our history. I don't know how you connect it with the archivist, but that's an entity who, even when he retired, was still the that we all called upon if we wanted to know something that had happened in the building. And Bill's nodding his head because those of us who were here finally knew that he was our historian.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we did work closely with Cecil while he was alive, and you'll note that the building is named
after him, which kind of makes that connection.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm going to turn the gavel over. Senator Winters, are you going to be here for a while? Or?
I will be here for a while if you would want me. Are you having to make a run?
Well, I do want to reflect for the record that you have had, at least for a part of the time, 100% attendance from the Senate contingent of the committee. I'll be back in about 5 minutes.
Can I please, Kathy?
It's going to take me a minute to get this fired up.
Got to get booted here.
Oh.
Unbooted itself.
But, you know, that is something, Representative Johnson. We have not had anyone who's picking up the gauntlet from Cecil.
Well, there's some enormously knowledgeable folks. I mean, I think immediately of Chet Orloff, who is as close to an expert in Oregon history as I know. And maybe some attempt, even though a presence wouldn't be in the building all the time, but some attempt to resurrect someone tapped with the responsibility of being the keeper of the historical flame. We lose a great deal absent that.
We really do. You know, Mike, when we had the old geezers and geezettes in this building, did you attend, Bill? That was getting individuals who were here in the 70s back into
yes.
the building.
Yes.
And that, you know, when I kind of got everybody stirred up to do that, I think it was from my standpoint of... we do have a rich history, and there's a lot of people who played important roles in this building, both the staff and legislators and execs, and I'd not like to see that die. Maybe we can have a conversation, you and I, with Chet.
I would like that. Mr. Secretary, would it be within the purview of the archives section of your office to spearhead an effort to have a gubernatorial appointment for a historian? What mechanism would that fall under were Senator Winters and I to take up the gauntlet to try to find a person to continue on in the tradition of Mr. Edwards? Nobody could replace him, but
no.
Certainly to follow on in that tradition.
We'd want the governor to make the appointment, and I'm sure that we could work something out so that he or she could do some work.
I'm thinking even just as modest an accommodation as a desk or a phone.
You know, doesn't have to be.
I'm pretty sure that's pretty available.
Well, the thing that I forgive me for leaving your presentation, but I was out.
It's okay,
in the
computers.
I was out in the hall having a conference with former Senator Neil Bryant, who serves on the board of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial in Oregon. And as we get ready to welcome 1 million visitors to Oregon who are here as what are called in the business heritage tourists.
Right.
These are tourists that travel for historical purposes. And their profile is that they are generally better educated, more disposable wealth, slightly older, stay in places longer, and are interested in an experiential visit.
Right.
That in this year when history is heavily focused on the state, that this might be an opportunity for us to renew an interest in having a nominated state historian so there'd be a go-to person for some of these issues. But Senator Winters, should you and I follow up on it?
Why don't you and I follow up on it and, meet with Bill and see what accommodations and possibilities are. I think it's an excellent idea, and we should have it ready for the centennial.
Right. All right.
Okay. Hey, I guess we're ready to start without PowerPoint.
Yep. Well, Kathy, you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Kathy Polino, Director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. Fortunately, we do have paper handouts of the presentation, and hopefully they're in your packet. So I'll go ahead and walk you through those as I would have at the PowerPoint presentation. A couple things that I wanted to briefly cover in my presentation is our legal authority and our responsibilities that we have for our office. how we carry out those responsibilities. Real briefly touching on some of our performance over the last few years and then what our budget's all about. I'll kind of hit on those quickly. First of all, as far as our constitutional authority, the Oregon Constitution basically says that the Secretary of State is the auditor of public accounts. And what that really means and the duties that the auditor of public accounts has assumed comes from the Oregon territorial statutes. Way back in the 1850s, they had a territorial auditor in Oregon. And I absolutely love the duties that are laid out here in the territorial statutes, and that's at the bottom slide on that first page. A couple things that I'd like to point out, because it's really kind of the mantra that our office lives by these days, is that the territorial auditor was responsible for lessening the public expenses, promoting frugality and economy in public office, and for a better management and more perfect understanding of the fiscal affairs of the territory. And that, to me, really hits home what our office is and what we're all about. And it links directly, too, to our government audit standards, which really says that, you know, public officials, legislators, and citizens not only really want to know, but they need to know whether government funds are handled properly and whether government organizations and programs are achieving the purposes for which they were authorized and funded. That's why we're here, and this is what we're all about. Leads to our mission statement, which is auditing to protect the public's interest and improve Oregon government. We have a number of different customers that we provide information for, but we see our main purpose as being that as a representative of the taxpayers, providing information back to all of you as representatives of the taxpayers so that you can do your job best. Our audits fall into four basic categories, and I'm going to hit on what those are really briefly. We do financial and compliance audits, and those make up about 40% of the work that we do. We do our single biggest audit is in this area. We do an audit of the state's financial statements, the single audit of the state's financial statements. We also, as part of that, audit and do financial opinion audits for agencies that issue bonds. And we also, as part of a requirement from the federal government, in order for us to receive federal funds, we also need to audit for federal compliance with those programs. And so that's a big chunk of what we do in our financial work. Another responsibility we have is that there's over 1,700 municipalities in the state, cities, counties, school districts, water districts. They all contract with private sector CPA firms for financial statement audits. Those are all forwarded to our office, and we do some oversight looking at the work of the CPA firms in those in that capacity. We have two staff that work on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. Having sat on the board of a special district for 8 years and seeing sort of quality of independent CPA audits come and go, do you guys, in doing your oversight of these 1,700 municipalities, if you see a pattern developing of failure to abide by commonly recognized accounting practices or any kind of anomalies, do you report that out in any way?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we report, part of our oversight responsibility is to do that review of the CPA firm's work, exactly what you're talking about. We make recommendations back to the CPA firms on ways that they can improve their financial reporting, and then we also report back to those oversight boards if it gets to that level. We have also made recommendations to the Board of Accountancy with regards to the work of CPA firms. So we do, we try to get them to work and improve their reporting through the least means possible, but we have brought it to other people's attention when
you've
had to. Second type of work that we do are what are called performance audits. There's a lot that falls into that category, but about 40% of our resources are dedicated to those types of audits. These are mainly fall into the categories of economy and efficiency and program results. brief examples of those: economy and efficiency. Our recent audit looking at the Lottery Commission's administrative expenses was looking at, you know, falling back on those territorial statutes, looking at frugality. Is it really frugal use of our resources? Are there opportunities to reduce administrative expenses so that those funds can be used for other purposes? Program results is where we're looking at what are the programs actually achieving. One of the best examples we have of this was in 1997. The legislature had a pilot project in Deschutes County for juvenile correction services. And basically what happened is for some of the lower offenses, they would house the juvenile offenders at Deschutes County, and the state would then give them the equivalent cost of what it would have cost to send them to the Oregon Youth Authority. And one of the questions that came out was, did it work? Should we expand the program, or should we discontinue it altogether? And so one of the requirements of that was that our office would go in and audit the program and see what the results were. And so we reported back not only the difference in the cost of the two programs, but also the outcomes. What happened to these youth when they left the facilities? Did they reoffend? Did they get jobs? Did they complete their education? And so that information is now available for policymakers to look at the two programs and the two different service delivery models so they can make informed decisions.
Representative Johnson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Typically, how long would an audit of that nature take?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, they vary significantly depending on the quality of the records. That one in particular was difficult because we had to look at the youth and then track them down after they left custody. And I want to say that that one took about 2,000 hours.
With a concomitant cost of?
Which translates to us about $65 per hour. It was expensive. And my where's Representative Butler when we need him?
if I recall, because it came back to my committee for to release the funds, it was expensive and not without its controversies.
But let's touch on that for just a second, Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me. What's the trigger mechanism to have such an audit, particularly the controversial ones? I'm trying to get a sense of auditors. I've always thought of as sort of independent watchdogs who have the ability to initiate audits individually and absent a lot of political oversight, and the ability to report out honestly what you have seen without a lot of political filtration. And I'm trying to get a sense, and I'm using this audit as an example, what was the trigger mechanism to commence the audit, and how do you immunize yourself against the temptation in a controversial audit for people with vested political outcomes to attempt to doctor your work product?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm going to take that in two parts because that's a big question for us. First of all, the first part of the question had to do with how did the audit come about. That one in particular was required in statute. There was a bill that was passed that required our office to go in and conduct this study. And so that is what we consider audit mandates. We have, let me take this. There's four basic places that audit requests come from. We have audits that are mandated from both the federal government, state government, and also in the Oregon Constitution. When Measure 66 passed that allowed lottery funds to be used for parks and salmon, there was also a constitutional audit requirement that went on top of that. Those mandates, and you know, I'm really glad you opened the door here, because those mandates have grown in our office over the last few years quite significantly. And what that's done is impacted our ability to do the audits that we would, as the constitutional auditor, choose to do based on risk. And so just to give you a real brief what's going on, in 1998, about 60% of the audits that we did were mandated work, so which really meant that we had about 40% of our audits were ones that we chose to do based on where we saw the risk to the state. 2001, that number was at 75%. So 75% of our audit work was mandated work, and we only had the ability to do audits in 25% of the ones were at our choice based on risk. The lottery administrative expense audit was one that we chose to do. We saw risk, and we acted on it. So that has really impeded our ability to do these other things. And so first category is mandated audits. We do get requests for audits from other places. One example, Senator Winters was on a committee last year that Senate President Durfler had questions on pharmacy reimbursement rates to institutional pharmacies. How much did that cost them? Because they were struggling with where to set reimbursement rates. So we went in, that was a requested audit, and provided information to the committee on what it cost to provide pharmaceutical services to the committee. So
let me break it down, though. Senator Durfler was Senate President and clearly part of leadership, so I could understand how that audit would come to the fore. But as a second-term legislator not in leadership, I can't just come to you and request an audit. I mean, there's a process, is there not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, anybody can come to us. However, there is a Joint Legislative Audit Committee is supposedly the mechanism to bring all those requests together. There is also currently a bill, House Bill, I can't think of the number right now, to look at making the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, which is now an interim committee, a standing committee, so that legislative requests for audits can be filtered, prioritized, and then those requests made, because it's very difficult for us to set legislative priorities for audits. We try to do our best to filter through all the requests that we do get so that we can meet both, you know, our constitutional mandate and getting our resources where they make the most sense.
Sure.
With meeting your needs for information. And so there is a mechanism, which is the audit committee. It is currently now just an interim committee. So we do our best to weigh all those with also our assessment of risk. And then we also have our fourth category, which is really our responsive audits. Sometimes things come up, and we have to drop what we're doing and go for it. There's a $250,000 fraud at economic development. We can't plan for those things. We don't always expect those to happen. But when they do come up, we want to make sure that the full extent of the loss is found and that the controls that allowed that to happen are addressed. So,
do you ever contract out for additional audit staff in the case of a $250,000 fraud, or do you rely strictly on state employees within your shop?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we do have some money in our budget, and I'll kind of talk about that, for contract audit services. But these are ones that we have certified fraud examiners on our staff, and our cost, frankly, is cheaper than what we could hire them out at.
I need to just to follow up, because you've moved from over time where you've had financial and compliance audits, and it appears as though, because of a variety of reasons, whether they're federally promulgated or state or constitution, and now that we're putting them in more and more bills, legislation, performance audits. Because I see here where your performance audits now is equal to, in percentage-wise, your financial and compliance audits. And I think probably if I went back in time in history, that was not really probably the case. Is that an accurate statement?
That's very accurate, Madam Chair. In fact, when I started with the office, almost 100% of what we were doing was our financial statement audits, and I came into the office in 1990 to begin to do performance audits. And so, and going back to Secretary of State Norma Paulus was a big supporter of doing performance audits. Barbara Roberts was the next Secretary of State and continued to bring in some resources to help push that envelope a little bit further. Secretary Kiesling was also a very, very strong supporter of those types of audits. And so we've progressed in that direction, and I think I'll continue through the presentation, but I think the value that our office has provided in response to that is...
What percentage of, you mentioned responsive audits, which are those that probably have more to do with fraud and some of this, but what percentage of those do you do in a biennium?
Percentage, Madam Chair, percentage of our resources dedicated to that, that would be about 5% of our resources, and that's on the next page. We talk about our special investigations. I'll go ahead and skip to that. That's okay. I'll back up. The 95 legislature established a fraud, waste, and abuse hotline. And so we man this hotline. And from that, I get all kinds of calls. But some of those actually turn into very productive and useful audits. And we do have a report that is being released, actually, I believe today, that talks about the source of those calls, what happened as a result of those calls, and kind of the, you know, where they go with that.
Madam Chair,
follow up.
Could I request, when you continue your presentation tomorrow, that if that report's released today, you would bring copies for the members of the committee?
I was going to make that same request.
The reason I'm so curious is I can't do a town hall without hearing about fraud, waste, and abuse, and it tends to be anecdotal. It tends to be repeated until it takes on the quality of truth. And what I say to folks is, if there are cases of fraud, waste, and abuse, bring it to the attention of legislators or the audits division or someplace, because our responsibility, now I love the new word frugality, but our responsibility is to identify that and stop it. And I would be very curious to see what kind of reports, if you're tracking them over time or geography, or that report I think will be fascinating.
Yeah, I would just ditto Representative Johnson, because we do either hear about it at town halls, people send us communication, and it would be, that report I think would be very valuable, not only for us, but I think it also will say something else to the public, that we do have within our system a vehicle that actually does go out and look and to try to remedy in this particular issue. So I think that's good. Okay.
And I believe, Madam Chair, what you'll see too is we had a spike when we first started, and the spike is starting to go back up too. So I'll make copies available for the committee.
Thank you very much.
With regard to that, just there are a number of different parties that are involved in fraud investigations, Department of Justice, the Risk Management Division, and ourselves, and we all have a little bit different viewpoint of how to approach these things. What our responsibility is looking at whether the full extent of a loss is captured. Did we get our arms around it and identify the full extent of the loss? And then the second piece is, how do we prevent this from happening in the future? And not only do we try to get that point across to the agency that experienced the loss, but how could we all learn from these mistakes and benefit from them? So that's how we approach those.
How much would your report detail? How much of the loss is attributed to, I talked about credit cards when we talked to facilities and the wide use of credit cards. Do you get in that issue as well when you're looking at some of the fraud cases?
Madam Chair, some of it, yes. But the bigger, I want to say, opportunities are available in other areas for defrauding the state, and usually it has to do with the smaller
agencies
or those that don't have their duties properly segregated, so someone can create. I mean, Department of Human Services also had about a $250,000 fraud recently, and it was a caseworker that could set up a person, issue payments, and we're issuing payments basically to.
So it's both small and large agencies.
That's right.
Authorization issues.
Opportunity and motive. And I'm just going to back you up one slide, which is our fourth type of audit that we do, which is information technology audits. We spend about 15% of our audit efforts in this area. And this is something that is of growing importance, especially now, because we have a number of payments that human hands don't even see. They're electronically submitted. We pay them out electronically. And the security and the functions over those systems are of critical importance to securing resources. So this is a growing area for us, especially in the security area. In the middle of page 4 is basically some of the priorities we have for the upcoming year as far as audits. Education. Obviously, cost savings audits are one thing that we're really focusing on. We actually went back and looked at some of our ideas from a few years ago that weren't implemented, and because times were not so tough, and we are bringing those ideas back up into people's attention. So,
on your education audit, your K-12, do you actually go out and audit some of the school districts, or is it just our Department of Ed?
Madam Chair, now you're getting into a line that we're just beginning to cross. We do have the authority to go out and audit school districts. We are starting, because we're just getting into auditing more in this area, we're starting with the higher level, where are we spending our money by school district? We just released a report that outlines the categories of expenditures, how they compare to national averages, and by district, how those expenditures compare to each other. This information, we hope, is going to provide that foundation for peeling that onion back. We're just starting part two of that audit, which is there were some cost categories that stuck out when we did this review. And so we're going to look further into some of those administrative costs and some support services that seemed higher than the national average.
Representative Johnson. Thank you, Madam Chair. You said phase one of that audit is completed and the report is out?
That's correct.
Could we impose on you to bring copies of that tomorrow, too?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, you bet.
And second part of that, because from your phase one report, you saw the need to go into phase two. I still want to go back to, I think there's some concern of since we as the state provide the major portion of the funding for K through 12. And I often get questions that relate to the school district. And I say, heck, I don't know what's going on in the school district. I don't think any of us at this level actually know, unless we're beginning to monitor the school boards and what have you. Is there the thought that perhaps we will be at some point have a responsibility of looking at specific districts?
Madam Chair, the extent right now of audits in school districts are financial statement opinion audits, and they're done by local CPA firms. There is a bill that's out there right now which would, it was focused on financial statement audits. My understanding is it's going to be rewritten to do some more performance audits in school districts. That is still in the drafting stages, is my understanding, but I know that there's some interest in that area. Our approach so far has been to look at topic areas that cross school district lines. We looked at infrastructure planning, which is a big part of school district costs schools, building schools. So we've been approaching them from those topic areas to try to get the biggest bang for our buck, because there is a lot of travel costs involved and all that when we start to get into individual school district audits. But I know the interest is out there, and we are trying to do our best to break into that area.
You have a question, Reverend Johnson?
Oh, no, sure.
Thank you very much.
I'll jump ahead to page 5 on your handout, a little bit about our performance and what we've done over the last few years. As I mentioned earlier, thanks to Representative Johnson's question about that squeeze on the mandates for us and our ability to do some audits, what we've done in response to that is to try to make the most strategic use of our resources. We want to get to the highest impact audits that we can. And so one of the things that we have done is looked at how many hours we were spending on our statewide audit of the financial statements, and we've really worked to reduce the number of hours it takes to produce the opinion on that financial statement. And you can see in 93 we spent about 61,000 hours on our statewide opinion audits, and today we've cut that down to 21,300 hours. What that's allowed us to do is to take those hours and shift them into more economy efficiency type audits and fraud, waste, and abuse investigations. So it's freed up some of our resources to do that. And then between 95 and 2002, our office has identified $131 million in cost savings or question cost as a result of our audits, and we're real proud of that. Especially considering the very next slide, if you take a look at
I guess
what
somehow happened. I would like to know whether the agency complied. And I don't know how, of looking at it, particularly where savings have been, highlighted by you, and hopefully, we're hoping that the agency complies, but we don't know whether the agency has complied or not.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and that's one of the things that we've kind of struggled with, is that we do get reports back from the agencies, but to actually go out and verify that changes have taken place is additional use of our resources, and we're trying to do our best to deploy those resources on audits.
I understand, at your level, it seems to me that presenting, if Agency X thinks that somehow there's not going to be, quote, the follow-up, you can continue to do business as usual, and you go back to and you hope that the agency gets the message.
and that they're not back doing the same thing over again.
Madam Chair, that is one of the functions that the audit committee's been playing. They've been asking not only for us to present audits, but then they ask the agency directors to come and respond to our audits at the committee meetings.
After the committee.
The middle slide on page 5 shows basically our staffing over the last few years. As you know, the dollars that we're spending have been increasing, so our responsibilities are gaining. The mandates on our office are increasing, but we've had a reduction in staff from 84.5 to our current level, which is 78. One of the things I'd like to point out on that is that we have dramatically, you can kind of see the darker gray on the handout is our management staff. And we've reduced our number of managers quite dramatically over the time. We now went from a span of control of 1 to 3.5 to now we're at 1 to 7. So the reduction in staff we've taken mostly in our management positions. The chart underneath that is the one performance indicator that I'm particularly proud of is that we've greatly increased the percentage of our money that we're spending on direct costs, which is our actual audit work. We took a real concerted effort at looking at our non-billable time and making as many reductions as we can to our administrative costs, and you can see that our percentages have gone down dramatically in how much we spend on our administrative costs. I can't take complete credit for all of that because we did have some brain drain and top-level administrators with higher salaries have retired. But a big chunk of this, too, is though our own efforts to get the cost going. Okay. Finally, just want to touch briefly on our budget. It is actually fairly simple. We are 100% other-funded agency. And statutes basically lay out how we assess for our audit costs. We estimate our audit expenses, and we assess to agencies based on their share of what we see as high-level audit risk factors, how much they spend, what their revenues are, how much cash they hold, and how many employees they have. And so we allocate it to them, and then with the exception of trust fund agencies, which we direct bill for our time based on an hourly charge rate. The other small revenue source for us is our municipal account. For those audit reports that we receive from municipalities, we also receive a filing fee, and that funds our two staff that do oversee the municipal audit program. Finally, the factors that drive our office, basically 80% of our budget is personal services. We're a service organization, so we're all about our people. Another 10% of our budget is actually contracting for audit work with private sector CPA firms. We feel we've got a real good balance there and have made strategic use of contracting for audit services. One thing I did want to point out quickly, though, is that our costs in that area are raising dramatically. Both changes in the accounting profession due to Enron and all those things that have happened, the number of auditing standards that are coming down the pipe are increasing, the amount of work that they need to do, and frankly, firms are getting a little more nervous about issuing an opinion with doing such little work, and so they are expanding the amount of work they're doing to issue their opinions. But you can see that the cost, this is one example for our Safe Corporation audit. In 2001 was $106,000, and in 2002 there was an addition to the financial work in statute and then also an additional actuarial review that was added as a mandate to our office. The cost of that audit is now $235,000, and we estimate that in 2003 it's going to go up to $290,000. So it's increasing dramatically. We also didn't get additional limitation, and so we're absorbing that within our budget. And that is end of my presentation. So
well, Kathy, thank you for a very comprehensive, very thorough presentation.
Sure.
And I think we will continue tomorrow with Jean and complete the Secretary of State tomorrow. And I think that the chair will probably be here tomorrow. And so with that, I think we're adjourned for the day.
Thank you very much.